like this is the quietest the room's been all weekend. Blimey. Alright, cheers guys. Just a disclaimer, this is the least prepared I've been for any element of the whole weekend, so thank you very much. It's been a fantastic weekend. How do you feel? So I know some of you didn't know quite what to expect when you came this weekend. I meant to do this right at the beginning, just a show of hands. Have any of you been to a hackathon or startup weekend before? Put your hands up. Okay. So only about a third of you have. The two-thirds of you haven't, which is really fantastic. Every time we do an event like this, we see a huge number of people who haven't been to something like this before. It's an opportunity for you to meet new people, number one, to network, to collaborate, and hopefully work on the that you take forward. But the most important thing is the educational experience you get from it. I think you guys should all be very proud of yourselves. You put in a weekend of work over quite a sunny weekend for most of it, apart from that one spot where the race that comes through the roof. I want to say thank you for all the people that made this possible. Looks like I'm just thanking myself right from the start. Thank you very much to my team and to Natasha, our events coordinator, right here, who made all of this possible. I need to thank our mentors who've been with you guys throughout this experience, throughout the weekend. Hands up with the mentors in the room just now. Okay. Thank you guys. And I want to thank our sponsors in particular. We are a huge thank you to Edinburgh Napier University, the sponsor of this event that helped us get the word out. We want to thank Informatics Ventures and SIE, again, they sponsored the event, they put the word out, they sponsored tickets, and many of you here, free, courtesy of these organisations. And to the other organisations, Edinburgh University, Harriet Watt, Glasgow School of Art. It's fantastic to see so many students along today. I want to thank David Noble. David is currently live streaming this. The talks will be recorded, they'll be available on Radio Edu Talk to download afterwards, and we've also got some filming going on as well. So this is, if you're a student right now, this is something that hopefully you can put in your portfolio, you'll be proud of. The audio will be available to download for free. And finally, so you'll notice that my badge switched halfway through the event, so I'm no longer your friend. Also judging today, we have Danny Helson from Informatics Ventures, and we have Robert, who've been also mentoring over the weekend. So you've got three different perspectives here. You've got myself. Obviously, you've got a startup. You've got Danny, who knows the Scottish startup ecosystem inside out, and he's going to be the hard-nosed businessman on the panel with a soft nose. And Robert, who understands the L&D landscape better than anyone in this room. This is the order of the pitches. Is this a surprise to anyone?
Does everyone know? So that's it.
That's it?
We're starting the pitches now.
Pitches now.
So can I ask you just to go the first team per order of what's on the slides, the first team to go backstage. That way you are all going to enter backstage. And give it.
Alright guys, it's all about to start. I know some of you are nervous, but as I said, you should be very proud of yourselves, so just round of applause for the work.
I'm a developer.
And this is Murphy.
10% was the amount of toys that a child goes through in their learning and developing years. What we realised is that per child per year, the average toy amount of toys that they go through is 39. This is not only really unsustainable for the environment, but enormously costly for parents. We also realised that a lot of the toys in the market are quite stagnant in the fact that they would teach a child one thing and one thing only, and after the child progresses further than that, they get thrown in a cupboard and never to be seen again. We wanted a toy that would develop it and be more intuitive. We also noticed that the more advancing toys were actually more focused on technology and apps and things like that, which kind of takes the toy away from a physical means to a digital means, which removes an emotional aspect for the children, which we think is really important for the development of a child. So why do children go through so many toys? It's mainly due to their varying interests as they get older, of course. And their different educational requirements as they learn and grow more. So we decided we needed a product that would kind of develop and encompass both of these things. And had a look at the toy market, and it's absolutely enormous. There's lots of room to develop and lots of scope to earn money and create a great product out there. So this is the little solution we're going to talk to you about. It's what we came up with this weekend. It's Murphy, the new morphing toy that learns with your child.
So how does he work? Murphy is a modular system which would be encased in a sort of outside exterior, be it a lion or a robot, depending on whatever your child is interested in. And you could add features such as lights, sounds, vibrations, or even a touchscreen. So using the modular system, you'd be able to add components depending on what features you want your child to have in your toy. And that means that it's customizable and unique to your child and creates a more personal toy for them. So such as Ryan, he's 3 years old, he's interested in animals, so he's chosen a lion, and with the use of interactive sounds and touchscreen, he can learn about animals, but as he's growing older, he's more interested in robots, and so this robot is used to learn math and timetables. So as you change the features, we don't want there to be waste, so we're thinking of creating a website that you'd be able to swap modules of Murphy.
So who are our target customers and consumers? The customers are the people that are going to be purchasing Murphy, so that's the parents and the toy stores, whereas the consumers are the people that are going to be using it, so that's the children. We're originally thinking of targeting age groups from 0 to 16, with the older bracket maybe more focused on the internals of Murphy and teaching them about electronics and how to code and things like that. So there's also scope for this product to be more directed into children with special needs because they have quite unique requirements when developing and growing up. So we ran out to the streets of Edinburgh to see if there was a place for Murphy in the market. We had a research around all the stores they were, what toys were available, and saw that there wasn't actually that many customisable options available. There was a couple, but they were quite limited in the customisability of it and how much input the parents and the children could have. We saw that our main competitor would probably be Lego because they have quite a lot of new technology coming out and new features which you can adapt your toys with. But what we saw was different in Murphy was that you could both interchange the internals and the externals, and both the user and the parent could have the utmost adaptability for the product. We also had a look at Project Aura, which is the Motorola project for the modular phone, which you slide in components and features to create your own phone. We think this would be a great opportunity to have us get involved and maybe have a collaboration with Motorola and use existing technology within Murphy to be able to take them to market and make them the best toy there is to be. Looking at costing, an average just like cuddly toy is about £20 right now, which is quite expensive when you think of our figure before, 40 toys per year per child, it's going to amount up enormously. So this is the benefit of Murphy, it's a true investment. The unit price retail is £40 right now, so that has a lot longer lifespan than the usual toy and will give us, the company, a £5 profit. But what it actually does is make sure that the company has continuous revenue as the customers are additionally buying the modular features to add on. They keep purchasing from us and keep advancing their Murphy toy. So how are we going to get funding? We're looking into grants and loans and reaching out to investors to help us with the manufacturing. We're also thinking about utilisation of crowdfunding through things like Kickstarter to get the Murphy out into the internet sphere and people involved.
Thank you.
Okay, cool. So that's Murphy, the toy that learns with your child.
question.
Now you have 3 to 4 minutes of Q&A from judges.
Well done.
Thank you.
That's good. Yeah, it looked like you've been out to some various shops. Did you actually talk to any people?
We did an online survey. We kind of wanted to throw it out to schools, but obviously it being over the weekend, we didn't have the opportunity to. But we did get quite a few responses, and it was all quite positive, and the respect that they'd like to be saving money and have more of a say in what their toys do for their children, and the sustainability aspect they're all quite keen on.
So what sort of responses did you get, number-wise?
I think we got about 15 responses. 100% said that they would actually be interested in getting more involved in what the toys teaching their children. I'm not sure what other figures there were. It was quite ranging on how much they said they were willing to pay for it. But everyone was really interested. I think it was like 90% interested in the like having to buy less toys, it being cheaper, having a longer life cycle.
Yeah. And where did you get your costs from? You said it was £35 for you.
That was Jay that did the costings.
Yeah. We took from a real-time selling databases like Amazon.com or some online shops. Like we took the the important tools like cameras, projectors, stuff needed for making the toy. And then apart from that, we included the manufacturing cost, the cost of like salaries and stuff.
And we kind of included the fact that with mass manufacture we'd be able to take the price down quite a lot as well, so that's included in this, hoping for kind of like a future projection of it.
And what would be your route to market for it?
What would be our software?
How would you sell it?
We're thinking mainly online or getting maybe brand endorsement involved. So perhaps you could have like a Peppa Pig version and like the Peppa team would get involved and they would help us. Just marketing, kind of pitching to toy stores initially.
What did you try in terms of the user experience, in terms of the, you know, how a child would actually change their toy? What did you?
We were initially kind of thinking it would be like everything would be able to be interchangeable, so like arms, legs, like head could all come off. We were hoping to take it to like a market research group where we could get feedback from parents and children, but we weren't actually able to do that, so we thought like what the safety requirements would be, so obviously we don't want choking and things going missing, so we thought it would be easier if it was just like one case for the exterior. That was kind of some development that we did, but we were hoping to do a lot more, but we just didn't have the chance to get any feedback from our users, but that's something that we would go on to do afterwards.
Apologies if you covered it. Just wondering, what was the original inspiration that caused you to work on the idea?
I think I pitched it. I think it was when everyone was kind of doing pitches. A lot of stuff was software orientated, and like as us as designers, we don't really know that much about software. And there was a pitch about storytelling. So I kind of got the idea sort of just from that, and sort of the thought that a lot of like there's a lot of children go through a lot of toys, and people don't want to get rid of them because of sentimental value, but then they're left in the cupboard somewhere. So sort of eliminating that sort of like saving stuff in the cupboard, being able to use them, sort of unwrapping.
We did that project at uni just not long ago about creating an educational and like playful experience, but making sure it's sustainable. So we all came up with loads of ideas. This wasn't actually one of them, but this kind of was almost inspiration from the back of that. Like, oh, that would have been a good solution, and it's kind of relevant to what's happening here.
I think actually that's very commendable, the conservation aspect of it. And I think that clearly is a market for that. But have you tried to, maybe as part of the... Okay, I'll just finish that. Have you balanced that against the desire to maybe give toys? Because you know, there's many occasions in it, as a child progresses, that friends, families want to give toys. So that's where the kind of the heap comes from.
I think with the possibility of the sort of, if we had like a swappable website, mm-hmm. that would mean there'd be sort of that sort of exchanging of parts that may not like. You wouldn't have to exchange money, but more of the sort of functions of like, upgrading, but through swapping kind of.
Yeah, it was almost become a new toy for the child as they get a new component that goes inside or a new exterior for it. So it is changing. It's not just one toy. It is completely changing and people can get involved in the gifting of that. And, yeah. Thank you.
Good evening, Hackathon, dear judges, organizers, participants, and guests. I'm very pleased to present my team, PhD, and we're proposing a technology for a visual guide for selecting postgraduate studies. So, we are a well-suited team of four people, two developers, Luis and Vipi, Stoyan, the business developer, and Algis, me, the designer. As a proof of international education market presence, we all come from three continents. How is that amazing? So, next, Andrea is an actual person. I share a flat with Andrea in Glasgow, and she's finishing her master's degree in engineering, and she's considering to continue PhD, postgraduate studies in machine learning, which is a rather specific area. So, I have heard from her a lot, and that's my motivation to work in this project along with my team. So how did she go, and whether her stories to me were real? We decided to test it in a next slide, please. We decided to test in a survey. So MapPhD conducted an online Google survey, from which we found out that students are actually struggling to finding a well-suited PhD degree. And next slide, please. We have asked in our survey what are the main criteria and tools in the search for that well-suited matching PhD. It turns out that people prioritize research area relevance, that means professor and student research area, and the researcher reputation, the number of papers published. So that means, in essence, connecting the student with the professor directly and then consequently with the university. Next slide, please. So is she alone? As it turns out, no. Postgraduate market is a rather popular market. It's quite crowded, and we believe there is a lot of potential with such big numbers as 25,000 PhD starts in 1 year in UK alone. Next slide, please. So we have looked at our existing competitors. There are more than three, but we selected the most populous in numbers. And these online tools offer text-based search, which we believe is not very effective. Some people admitted in the survey that they look at the university websites, but it is a very tedious work to go through all the websites. So, next slide, please. Our tools, we defined early on our key values would be the ease of use, visual presentation, and interactive communication with the visitor to our website. And basically, we are displaying statistical data about the research ongoing researchers and professors and their interests in graphic icons on the map. So please look at our video, which shows the... It is loading now. But you can also fire up your mobile phones, go to our Twitter website, which is where you can find the link to our website also. Fire up a video file then directly.
No, no, let's not waste time. 1 minute.
Because this is an actual working tool.
Well, my name is Stoyan, and you couldn't see, but the tool is pretty cool looking, and it's quite helpful not just for candidates. At the start, we plan on working with universities, by providing them with near live data on their popularity, department and researcher searches as well, and that's how they can benchmark against their competitors. If traffic proves sufficient in the future, we'll be able to generate click-through revenue by connecting the users to the application page directly. Our survey showed that employment after graduation is one of the most important criteria for choosing a PhD. Therefore, we plan on working with employers in the future and by matching them with candidates who are willing to possess the right skill sets. We also plan on providing more information and assistance with funding and grants, therefore working with private providers or governments. One of our mentors was kind enough to share her frustrating experience finding a PhD program, which is still going on. And she said, quoting her, my PhD is amazing, it's quite useful. She would even be willing to pay for it if it wasn't for free. Thank you very much.
We are open for questions, and in the meantime, we will try to show the video of the project.
I've seen the live prototype, so I trust you. It works. But one of the questions I had was the data that you were using for the MVP. Is this actual live, accurate data that you, or is this sample data that you've used thus far?
Okay, so we currently gather data manually from university and professors' web pages, which are publicly available. But in future, we can create a crawler for automatically scraping data from websites. And also, there are many public academic research APIs, for example, Microsoft Research API.
Sure.
And also, we can like use crowdsourcing, for example. So we may ask universities or professors to provide data for themselves on our application.
And just one other question on that: like, how do you know that the PA, how do you know that it's still available? How do you prevent the data from getting stale when you keep refreshing it? Do you just assume if you can't find it again in a month, then the opportunity's gone?
That's why we plan on collaborating with universities, so we can update our database as much as possible. So all the researchers who are shown are still looking for PhD candidates. So it's going to be more of a personal touch rather than being just a service for finding researchers.
So you bootstrap by scraping the property compilation?
Yeah.
In terms of, it does look good. It has to be said. But what made you choose a map as the primary dimension as opposed to other things?
So one of the key advantages of the map, for example, when we are searching for some specific keywords, for example, machine learning, then we can see where people are concentrated, where the researchers are concentrated in a specific region of the world on that research area.
It's more intuitive to go down the map, so it's from the big picture rather than coming up.
Sorry, just a way around. Being sure. How are you going to make money? Who's going to pay you for this?
How are we going to make money?
You want to make money, don't you?
Okay. So I said, collaborate with universities. So by providing them live data, we're probably going to charge them. And if we have enough traffic, we're going to aim for click-throughs. We're also considering ads by employers or universities or even people providing grants and funding for a PhD. That's on a later stage for advertising, but at the beginning.
Did you ask a university if they pay for it?
No, but we've taken a look at our competitors. They're quite heavily advertised by universities.
Okay.
And by different funders.
Yes, well, some mentors also said that university will be willing to know that they are standing on the same or maybe more advantage than their competitors.
Mm.
So they probably won't.
It was interesting. You said your mentor had said that was it was a great idea. She would have paid for it.
Sorry?
Your mentor,
yeah.
Diana, said she would pay for it, didn't she?
Yeah, she said.
I mean, it's so good that people are willing to pay. Then I'm fine.
That's what I was saying.
But we would like to stick with the free service for the students.
Yeah.
I think it's the value of the.
our users are going to be students, which is going to be free, and then customers are going to be universities and employers eventually, as well as conferences further on as well.
Is that a good time?
Just in time.
Thank
you.
Studying Festival and Event Management in Edinburgh Napier University. Together with my course mate Masha and three natural language processing students from University of Edinburgh, Becky, Miriam and Annabelle, we have developed an idea for an app called Don't Miss Out. So as students, we receive a lot of email from our universities offering a lot of great opportunities to participate in seminars or sport events, but sometimes it seems that it's just too much of them and we might skip some of these amazing opportunities. Therefore, we conducted the research and we found out that half of the students have the same problem. The emails are too much, they're irrelevant, and these opportunities we miss very often. After discussing these issues with people working within the universities, we discovered that it's also an issue for them that they can't reach the audience they want and they can't engage as many students as they want. Therefore, our solution is to develop an app that could help both of the parties. Students will receive relevant opportunities based on their interests in a clearly understandable visual form. And at the same time, organizations who want to provide these kind of opportunities to the students would reach their target market, as well as receiving feedback about their promoting strategies and the profile of the people who are actually interested in their offered opportunities. So now my colleague is going to go into depth about app itself.
So the idea is to create an application that will be able to go through your emails and select all of those that are events and those that are relevant to you, and then put them into an easy-to-read format in a calendar. So the user experience will begin with a login page where you'll be able to sign up and then create a profile, obviously giving your email address and password because those are necessary to access the emails, and also giving some things that are relevant to you, such as interests and degree titles, so that we can sort through the emails and select the correct ones. There are multiple views that can be used in the app. So this is a week view where we'll be able to see the different categories of events, which makes it clearer, and there's also the opportunity to select those which are most useful to you or most relevant, and then hopefully put those into maybe a Google Calendar, for example, or delete those that just aren't useful to you at all. This is a category screen, so you could maybe view the categories that you wanted just as a different way to view it, and a month view as well, where you'll be able to click on a link to the particular event and therefore to the email and maybe get more information or click on any links that might be in that email. The email, it would actually be an email client hosted on a server just like Office or anything like that, except for the fact that it would contain a natural language processing component that would sort through the email and use regular expressions and pattern matching to find the correct emails and then output them as a format that would be set to the application and then presented in a helpful calendar view as explained before. We do actually have a working prototype, although this is very simple as we've only developed it over this weekend. But it begins with keyword matching, so the interest that we put in at the beginning, and event detection, which at the moment is only based on dates but could obviously be improved as we're natural language processing people, so we do have those kinds of skills. So you can see that it classifies 44% of emails in terms of relevance and 57% in terms of events.
So the big question is, can this actually be a successful business? And the answer is, yes, of course it can. Our idea is to start locally in Edinburgh, because there are 7 higher education institutions who might be interested in this, as well as 54,000 students. After that, when it's successful, we're going to broaden our market to all of Scotland, or even furthermore, to entire UK. So our startup cost is around £50,000, and it will take us 6 months to develop this application. After launching our application, we will get income from several sources, like students purchasing apps, sponsors, and membership fees from institutions like universities or other companies who are interested in targeting their events to the students. Thank you for your attention. Check it out. Don't miss it out. We have a Twitter account. You can go on Twitter and find us there for more information. So do you have any questions for us?
What do you need £50,000 for?
So we just made the list of the things, mostly it's for the employees who are going to work on the project. So it's mostly IT people, like developers, design, and people who are actually going to launch the whole thing, plus marketers and PRs.
So you've got 3 developers already?
Yes.
They're expensive developers.
The biggest expense when it comes to the wages is like... is the lead developer, which we need a professional, and the project manager, who we also need a professional, and they're not cheap.
It's the way that you can do this in an unscalable way to start getting traction at the beginning without having to spend that money on development.
The issue is all the back-end development that is involved in making an app and sorting out the email client and that kind of thing. We require actual developers. We're just natural language processing people. We would actually need someone to do that kind of heavier.
So it's a UX side that you're going to need to maybe bring someone in on.
Yeah, we're going to check.
Have you surveyed any of your stakeholders on your business model about who wants to pay how much?
Yeah, we did actually talk to Sarah at LaunchEd. And she was mentioning that they'd actually just been talking to someone who was offering a similar kind of solution, but for a lot more money that they weren't able to afford. And we discussed the fact that as we would be a startup and probably quite a lot cheaper than that, mm-hmm. there was definitely a need for this kind of service. And we've also had a lot of interest from students as well. We've done a survey on the students, so there's interest from both sides.
And Sarah also said that there is no application that does what we want to do, which that there's features in there that she'd be actually very interested in that no one else can offer.
We were also talking with staff from Edinburgh Napier University, the people who are actually sending out these emails to us, and we've been discussing this is a problem for several years and they can't find the solution, because emails of course is the first way how you reach it, but because it's so much information and it's not prioritized, then they don't get what they want and students are just overwhelmed with this massive information.
Yeah, I think in that sense it's quite clear that there is a market and it does have features, but I think there might be still some figuring out to do about who is actually willing to pick up, pay to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm. We asked students if they would be interested in this app, and 80% of the students we asked, they said that they will be. Well, they are interested in this app, and for the most 60% said that they're willing to pay something between £0 to £5 for app. Mm-hmm. So this is one of the incomes that we're going to get from the students, because it's a huge issue, and the other is also from the organizations, because as we mentioned, we met with some of them, and all of them were interested and would be willing to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go on.
I know, excuse me, just to be devil's advocate, if someone's willing to make a purchase there and put money into this, is there not an easy way of going about it? Because they could just, you could take your approach is quite interesting because it's user-driven. So you're assuming that the institution is not going to budge. They're still going to send out these emails. You're trying to solve a problem from the student's perspective, and you're going to take these emails. But if you approach the university directly, then you're kind of saying that they're going to pay for it, but they're not necessarily. Why wouldn't they then just change their approach to email, and why would they not just then direct students to maybe a calendar? Or
well, the discussion was that, in fact, if they were to pay for the software, then they would be the ones advertising it to the students and telling the students to buy that kind of software, which would then make it easier on both sides. But, I mean, there's also the possibility that the university could send those kinds of emails to a separate account, which would then distribute them to all of the students. There's a lot of possibility for expansion in this kind of thing.
And also, we're also thinking of doing some sort of feedback feature so that the university sends emails and then gets feedback on the interest of the student in the event, and they can delete the email from the email list based on that.
And they will also get the profile that this person might be interested in other events, and they can say develop possible further cooperations with other institutions. So it would be more global rather than just working within the university. Sorry.
Treehouse, and we are a self-development online platform which helps people grow to their full potential. Okay, so as you all know, self-development is a huge industry, especially in the States, where it's worth over $11 billion. This industry is composed of books and seminars, but we're actually going to focus mostly on books. This is our niche market.
Good.
So this is the problem. Because of this vast array of information and resources, people are lacking direction. They're struggling to make sense of all this, and this leads, in turn, to lack of commitment. It's hard to commit to a long-term goal or a New Year resolution if you have so many resources. What we do, what's our solution, is that we provide individuals with the tools, in this case the reflection and the action elements of our service, resources, which is the books, the central part of our offering, and the community, the people who support each other to achieve their goals. My colleague Andy will describe each element.
Hi. So firstly, we've got this underlying layer of community. This is a community of like-minded people. People are in a similar situation, moving towards a similar vision. And this feature really filters through the other parts of the service. So you can see that there's an interaction with the community at this point. You can ask questions, post comments, inspire and encourage. Then you've got this other layer of books. So authors can publish books on this platform. And the books, kind of similar to a Kindle, for example, but a Kindle with community input. So it's like you can ask questions, you can post comments, and this helps to kind of give different perspectives on an author's piece. So then at the end of a chapter, you're posed with a challenge the author has proposed. And this can be something that you can carry into the real world and actually try out and have like an experiential experience. So then we have the actions tool. So the actions tool is goals, habits, accountability measures. Like, for example, here we have a 10-minute meditation, something that you can carry out into the real world and start performing. And then reflections tool. So this allows you to record and recall things that you experience in the outside world as well as on the app. And so we're going to target a number of two different consumers here. So firstly, the consumers of books, people who are interested in self-improvement. So firstly, students. Then we're going to branch out a little bit and start to engage people in the social media. and then target people using Facebook ads who are interested in self-improvement. Secondly, we've got the customer group of the authors. So we all know a few self-help authors that we're going to bring into the service already who've acknowledged that they're interested. And then we're also going to target more influential characters who have blogs and social presence. And then finally, publishers like Penguin, who publish self-help material, got quite an umbrella of this material that we can introduce into the service. So firstly, we're going to do, generate revenue through book sales. So this is going to take a small commission from the books that we sell. Secondly, through freemium models. So as users who are quite using the service quite intensely, we can put a cap, a threshold on this service. And then we have advertising, which is authors who want to advertise their books, publicize their books, can pay for this service. And then finally, as the service grows, this is more of a long-term solution. Big data, so we can sell data to governments, healthcare, NHS. Might be quite useful. So firstly, the first thing is going to be a very basic like Kindle-like platform that will allow authors to put challenges into books and for communities to interact with those challenges. And the second layer is more of like an advanced interface, so encouraging more of a more users and authors to interact with the platform in a better user experience. And then finally, more community features and community action features that allow community to better move around the service and to better tailor the service around their needs.
Okay, and let's see who stands in our way. Success is basically only kind of two organizations, both of them from the United States. Everest is bringing to the table a journey-like kind of a platform, whilst Lyft is more of a to-do list. What we do at Treehouse is we bring both of these elements into one roof, into a holistic solution. So remember, don't lose yourself to self-help. Let us guide you through this journey and provide you support along the way. Thank you.
Your main revenue is going to come off commission, is it, initially?
Sorry?
Your main revenue is going to come off commissions, is it? Book sale commissions?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So that's the first stage for those two targets.
So what's stopping me going to Amazon?
So this has an additional value proposition of the challenges inside the books. So this book system interacts with, you see the actions, goals there. So you've got habits and goals. So an author can create a piece of material and say, okay, a challenge I want to set to users is to go out and meditate for 10 minutes every day. And they can like directly integrate that into their tools. So the book kind of has this flow to it where you've got stuff that you can read and then practical things that you can act upon. That helps to reinforce the knowledge.
Okay. And then, I mean, there's going to be sort of multiple book offerings per topic. How are you going to rank the different books?
Well, I think that's one of our strongest features. You have a community that will rank this massive amount of self-help material. So instead of you spending weeks searching through books and then not finding anything of use, we'll have a sort of ranking system. You know, this is user saying these are the best books. And if you go to their profiles, you can see how they've used those books and how it's helped them progress. So it's a very direct way of seeing what will be useful to you.
So a couple of questions kind of linked actually. The content for this, does it have to be designed specifically for this platform? And are you looking to get authors to produce content exclusively for the platform as well?
So we're looking to kind of target quite holistically, like a lot of self-help authors that perhaps like already have material that could be placed on this platform and given like an additional value proposition of the challenges, or indeed give authors perhaps that are kind of new, up and coming, the possibility to integrate their material into this as well. So it's kind of a bit of both.
To a certain extent, to get the full value of the platform, they're going to have to do work above and beyond the content that they might have already produced.
Sorry.
Well, I mean, some of the interactivity is going to require their involvement beyond. They've maybe written a book, and then they're going to need to think beyond that to actually get the full value from the platform.
Yeah, so I think there's going to have to be some kind of participation with publishers and authors, like initially, perhaps like literally
perhaps like giving us the material to put on the platform and just do the back work for them initially, but perhaps like as the service kind of gets a bit of momentum, then authors would be encouraged to do that themselves.
I think what's also beneficial to authors is with this platform, the community can kind of input onto what happens to the books. So instead of the author just creating this new material based on what they think should work, they'll have live sort of interactive feedback of users saying, well, we suggest this action plan, or this is the exercises that most helped us when we were working through this book.
And it's good that you have a number of different revenue streams, but with all of them, well, all of them apart from freemium, have you considered issues of trust? In the sense of, can I trust you to be a neutral recommender of book sales? And in terms of advertising and big data, given that you know this is some fairly personal data that you're dealing with, why should I trust you as a consumer?
I guess anonymity. I mean, we were discussing about privacy was a huge issue for us initially. We were like, how to tackle it? It's anonymity. It's kind of the backbone of all blogging. Anonymity. Provide users the option to use kind of their real name and so on, but also anonymity. Because they just, in the end, it can be just as a journal to put your thoughts in there and get some feedback upon them. So, yeah, anonymity, I think.
Plus, it might be a good idea to separate which books are pure advertising and which books are rated by users of the service. This will separate the kinds of advertising.
Thank you.
Cool.
Sorry.
Wanted to have control over the story you're reading or even become part of it? Well, I'm pretty sure you did. And the good news is, we have a solution for you. The heart of our concept is the ability to customize books, become the main character, and explore each story uniquely. We help cash-rich but time-poor parents to keep their children entertained and educated, and at the same time, we offer a unique learning and reading experience for the children. What makes us unique is the fact that our books are not only customizable, but also interactive. We offer three different products. First, non-customizable books, which basically are classic fairy tales with beautiful animated illustrations. Second, customizable books. In these books, children can provide us with basic data about their appearance and character, and then we could use this data and integrate it into stories. And third, interactive books. In these type of books, children have the opportunity to make decisions about different choices they're making and how the story is going to progress. The key benefits of our product are facilitation of learning, reading, and creativity. Also, learning and reading stories is a great way to expand vocabulary and improve reading comprehension. To illustrate our idea, Donald has a quick demonstration for you.
Hi, so judges, this is all about your story today. So first of all, Alan, is it a sunny or cloudy day in your world?
It's a very sunny day.
Great to hear. And Wilbert, where would you like to live? In an old windmill or a new windmill?
A new windmill.
Perfect. And Danny, what's your favorite color?
Blue.
There you go, it's just like you. So you can see this is all being generated really quickly, and you can get a good idea of what it looks like if you can export it to either a digital copy or even a hard copy if you want to print it out for the premium. And we can even flip this around and make it a bit more educational by asking questions based on the content generated either by user input or automatically. So, everyone, what color is the girl's dress? Well done, everyone. I think you've learned something today. Great. I'll hand you back to Michaela.
Brilliant. Thank you, Donald. Well, even though there are already many companies offering electronic fairy tales to children, our idea is unique because our competitors do not offer the option to customize or let alone interact with stories. The situation on the market is favorable for us too. The digital reading market is experiencing a rapid growth and children's reading habits are quite good too. 2/3 of children aged under 13 are now reading digitally, and most of these kids read for at least once a week. What is more, We distributed an online survey to over 30 parents and found that all of them own a compatible device with our idea. Most of them read to their children every day, and the majority of parents are already reading ebooks or want to try them soon. We use a freemium subscription model to give our customers a taste of our product, and we also offer a choice between regular and premium subscriptions for key additional features. Our regular subscription gives access to customizable books where the child customizes the character. These can then be downloaded for a small fee. Our premium subscription is the ultimate experience, which includes unlimited access to interactive books and which allows children to make decisions about what is going to happen next in the story. On top of that, children can download one free customizable book per month with this premium subscription. When we break even between quarters 5 and 6, we expect our profits to grow rapidly because the variable cost of developing a book is high initially, but once we have a substantial number of users, it dilutes as the book can be used infinitely. In order to break even, we need to achieve approximately 6,700 subscribers, which we plan to get by social media engagement, attending book fairs, gaining endorsement from popular parent bloggers, and placing adverts strategically on relevant websites. Our startup capital is £50,000, which includes the development cost for 10 full books. In order to get started, we will need a variety of skills, but we are confident that we have identified a great opportunity and that this idea has a huge potential. So, to wrap up, let me say that if you're unique, try Storyeek. Thank you.
Who's your competitors in this space at the moment?
For instance, there is MeGenius and Story Before Bed, and these companies, they basically only offer classic fairy tales. There are no frills except for audio, and these they have a subscription model, but the uniqueness of our idea is the fact that there's no customization in our competitors, and there's no way how to interact with the story whatsoever.
In terms of the app, I mean, it looks really slick. But have you considered what the how the back end would work? What's the architecture that sits behind it?
Well, just now it's all front end actually, mm-hmm. But there is the opportunity to save the choices to a back end.
Okay.
Which means if you're paying, say, for a subscription, you can actually have sessions and come back and keep your progress. Mm-hmm. But just now it doesn't require any back end. But we could obviously expand on that.
I suppose, I guess the question would be, if you were to take this forward, what would be the first thing you do? I mean, you mentioned a 50k startup cost, so is that just on the content generation?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Is the startup cost really on the content generation or on the technical implementation?
It's both, I would say. I mean, it's like a full startup cost. It includes rent, it includes wages for our developer and other things like insurance and things like that. But also there is the budget is for 10 full books for the development of these books and 4 servers for the first.
So if you didn't get £50,000, what would be the cheaper way of getting bootstrapped and getting off the ground?
I'd learn to draw.
But this is in the case that we have to outsource most of the work. But we are quite confident that with our skill set, we could actually save more money. But this is like the idea in case we had to outsource lots of work, then we should be able to do it with 50k.
Just out of interest, would you consider kind of partnering up with one of the major publishers?
Yes, that's one of the ideas. That's not for the time at the moment, but eventually, yes, we're thinking not only about publishers, but also about having enterprise subscriptions, schools, maybe libraries and other educational facilities, but yes, this is something that you have to consider.
And also, it's someone could supply us with the images they wanted and the characters and the story parts that they want. We could easily make a toolkit, so that's another option for people to interact with themselves and pay to distribute it.
But wouldn't you kind of create your own competitors that way?
We create our own,
Passionate users.
Yeah, I mean, people could reach a new audience by interactivity. They're doing that somewhere else.
Where's the team from? Are you all from far and wide?
But we're all from various countries, yes. Yes.
But are you currently based in the same place, or?
Well, it's Edinburgh and Glasgow.
Oh, Edinburgh now.
And what was the thing, the hook that made you start on this?
I'm sorry?
What was the original idea? What made you go down?
Well, it was 2 a.m. insomnia. And I thought it would be great to have someone to read me a bedtime story.
Was this insomnia before or after this weekend?
We already have that. I had this idea about a year ago.
Have you run it past the 5 year?
No, unfortunately not. We didn't have time to do that. We didn't have any 5-year-old.
There is a live demo, so if any of you have kids at home, you can try it out. You can find the link on Twitter.
Yes. We have a Twitter account.
Francisco.
I'm Gordon.
And this is Amy.
This is Amy.
And we're Interact. Okay, so basically we develop physical interactive platforms for both users and company/events. Right? So, yeah. The technology, we have User A. And User A would be developing motion interactive games and stress relieving exercises for people that spend a lot of time in front of computers, basically. User B would be an interactive environment with multiple users. We'll get to that later. Simple technology, camera-based software, detects motion, maps it to some sort of projector, etc. Okay, so the problem. As you can see, that's the problem. There's a strong decline in physical activity and social physical interaction throughout the last decade or so. Here's some stats. A good thing to highlight that BBC pointed out is that, all these are from the Scottish Government page, is that in average, kids spend 6.5 hours per day on a screen, which is quite worrying, actually. Yep, this is just showing how we would like to be in terms of exercise and how we're going. Wait, backwards?
It's
jumping. Okay, we're having a technical issue here. Okay, go slowly. Why did it decide not to work? Okay, we're having a technical issue here. We'll do the videos after. Okay, so skip the videos. We have two videos. So our user B interface, which would be set, we're using the use case of a dance studio. And we would like to illustrate, like, the walls, project the movements of the dancers, and, you know, evaluate more or less, like, how well they're doing, contrast a silhouette of what the ideal movement will be like versus their silhouette. The process is, well, we have a package designed for the company, for the dance studio, that we already have pre-made, and we could customize it if they need so. If not, when we do just give them the package straight away, and we make a big cost for that package. In terms of how we're going to approach the market is we're going to start doing this for free. We're going to target events. We're going to go to our first event on the 21st. We're going to go to Edinburgh Electronics and map some graphics that map what people are doing around. So to build a reputation, start off, how would we work out in terms of selling? We'll rent on equipment, sell software. Last slide. Here's mapping some of the many other uses that it could have. We could work for club nights, displays in museums, sports and activities, and such. So this is the end. Sadly, we did not manage to get it working. Let's see what's happening. Okay. So here's a quick video of our story. We developed everything from scratch. And it's playing and not playing. Okay. Can you put it small screen? Okay, let's see the shot. So we started from scratch developing this software, and the idea evolved throughout the thing. Originally, it wanted to be a brush that tracked motion. Oh, wow. It's not good. Yeah, this works. Oh, come on. Okay, so this doesn't like full screen. No, it doesn't like a video. Damn it. Yeah, more or less, we just started from scratch. We developed the software, the idea evolved. And like you can see in the video, we would try and map the silhouette of the correct movement in contrast to the movement you're doing and such. And here's, yeah, some playing around with the software. here was the idea we had in terms of dance studios for a case study. And obviously, because it has motion detection, we'd like to map the correct movement such that the user can get to the point he'd like eventually become that ideal silhouette. So, yeah.
So can you just clarify for me? You're saying there's the two users. The first one's for inactive, you said kids, but everyone.
Well, inactive everyone. From workers, if you spend like a bunch of hours in an office and you'd like to, in your small breaks, you get interact, play a game, maybe a yoga game or a relief stress ball that displays on your computer and you play around with it. So that's user A. User B is the case study we did where we showed the dancers and such.
So it's a teaching aid, training aid.
Yeah, it's a training aid. It's a training aid, ideally, yeah. And it's like, we aim to teach, like, body awareness, physical awareness, which is something that's been lost nowadays, yeah.
And then how are you going to make the money from it?
So we make an app, yeah. So the games are app-based games, and the customers can purchase it for a low cost. As for the packages to sell to companies, well, there'll be dance studios, and there'll be a higher cost per package. And if they want to customize it, then we increase the price.
So are you going to sell the app directly, or is it more like you're selling the platform, the technology to particular companies, and then they sell their app?
Okay, so for users, app directly. Okay. Yeah. For companies, is we're selling them a tool they're going to be using in the company, along with their dancing courses, etc. And if they need extra features in that tool, if they need some... Like, if a museum, for example, wants a French Revolution event and they really want to customize the app that already exists, then we charge more for the customizing process, depending on how big of the scale the project would be.
So in the consumer app, how would...
In the user one.
Yeah, the user one, where would the kind of the good examples come from?
Okay, so in the user one, it... Like... One of the ones we looked at was like a yoga type of example, and you follow a silhouette and it tells you if you're going wrong or not. So just look at a small set of courses, videos that already exist that are open source online, that you know are standard, and construct these games, these interactive games. One of the market advantages actually would be that companies that do similar things work with the Xbox Kinect, and not everybody has an Xbox Kinect. This would be a laptop, a phone, so because it's all camera-based technology, makes it really accessible. Yeah.
So I just want to ask you a question just to reiterate on your point. So you, this software, you developed yourself?
Yeah, completely, yeah. It's not using any, I just coded it from scratch.
Okay, and at the moment it's proprietary, so you haven't open sourced it or...
No, nothing. It's not open source yet.
And do you feel, in terms of other software that might be out there, open source and proprietary, that there's any particular things that allow you to develop this into a particular space that maybe other software can't really tackle very well?
Sorry, can you?
I mean, so this you've developed this completely from scratch. Right?
Yeah,
so
over the weekend.
Software out there. So is there anything about your implementation that could maybe tackle problems that existing solutions couldn't?
Well, one of the things is the fact that we have developed it from scratch. Of course, it can evolve more, but the fact that we're coding it from scratch allows it to modify it a lot more. So what could it tackle? It could tackle the user's demand, the personal need, and such, to customize these apps in terms of the companies.
In writing yourself, you're able to be more responsive in terms of the custom applications?
Yeah. Because in a sense, we also provide a service along with the software, so we're a lot more responsive to the actual needs, maintenance, and such.
So we're like an ideal team that could go into any situation and create something bespoke, which basic software couldn't provide. We can go in and make that interactive interface personal.
Yeah, if they want something customised, we'd catch requirements first and then we'd adapt it to the software we have already developed.
We're on 3 seconds.
Did you do any marketing research?
For user based, in terms of like research, we displayed the stats quite quickly, so we didn't want to spend much time going over them. But we looked at the amount of like exercise adults are getting per week, mm-hmm. and they're really small numbers. Right. So there is a strong need for this to provide exercise within the work environment, and it's we're stuck to computers. We can't get rid of that, but let's try and work around it and develop it. So yeah.
Redevelop. Hi there, my name is Adam, and I'm proud to present my team, Redevelop. And first of all, can I ask you to put up your hands if you own currently something truly unique to you, something that no one in the world has? Right, now put up your hands if you ever wanted to have one. Right, the thing is that the technology for this is actually out there. It's called 3D printing. But the problem is that not a lot of people know how to use one. So we decided to tackle this problem and came up with a solution in the form of an app. An app that enables you, that gives you the tools to actually personalize or create your own 3D files. But if you don't have a 3D file, where can you get it? So that's how we actually implemented a marketplace for you to get your 3D files, or if you're a designer, to actually sell your designs. So let's look at how it would work. Say, Leon owns an iPhone, and he wants a truly personalized 3D phone case. So he goes to the marketplace, and can add textures, and textures upload actually a picture, or just put some text on it, and actually preview it. So he decides he wants to add some text. You just tap it in, and then place it. Well, it looks quite cool. So he actually saves it for 3D printing. Download a kit and build his own personalized iPhone case. In terms of the actual app, we have a working prototype that's built in a cross-platform engine. And as you can see, we can have a cube or a cylinder. And that's some more.
Hi. Also, based on the market research we have done and the graph you're going to see now, the interest in 3D printing has grown significantly over the past 58 weeks this year. We also decided to do a customer survey here in Edinburgh and identify people's perceptions on 3D printing if they're going to use our platform. And 90% of them said that they see value in what we're offering them and they would use the mobile app for customizing their own products. However, 100% of them said that they would actually require help in finding the 3D printing facilities. So what we did in terms of the value proposition of our service, obviously, we are user-friendly and we would enable non-professional customers to use our product. Also, based on the survey we did, we identified that our target market is non-professionals within the 13-25-year-old spectrum. And because of the responses from the survey, we decided that we would partner with 3D Hubs, which is an online platform which will enable customers to find the closest 3D printing facilities next to them. And this will add value to the whole application, plus the fact that they will be able to customize their own products. In terms of revenue streams, our market research showed that we have estimated that 50% from of the revenue stream will come from the marketplace and 10% will come actually from the 3D printing shops that we, local 3D printing shops that we plan to partner with. In order to break even, we estimated that at the end of year one, we would need to acquire 22,000 customers. In terms of competitor differentiation, we are the only mobile app that basically enables you, doesn't require special skills in order to enable everyone to create their own customized product. Unlike our main competitors, which is Shapeways, we would bring together the community by using local 3D printing companies. So get ready to make your wildest idea become tangible. Thank you.
What's your spend per customer then?
Sorry?
How much is each customer going to spend? 20,000?
Well, for the file that we are going to, on the app, customers will need to download a file which will cost them £10. No.
Right, so basically, there's a marketplace, right? We would enable, give them files, but what we want is for designers to actually upload them and sell them. So a file could cost from £5 up to £4,800. It depends on the file. It depends on how big the file is, how complex or what it is, actually. And, yeah.
What's your target age group? 13?
13 to 25.
Did you consider, for the marketplace, partnering up with some of the competitors that you mentioned, the more established? Because you could argue that maybe the as you said, the added value is in the mobile app. So
what we want is our key partners would be actually 3D local 3D printing shops, right? Our competitors would be Shapeways or TurboSquid. TurboSquid gives 3D files, they set 3D files as well. Mm-hmm. And Shapeways, it's a company in America where you can upload your file and then you get actually the 3D file posted to you. As she said, our differentiation is that it gives you the power to print it out locally, so you can get actually, like in an hour or in 2 hours, the actual product that you want.
Why would Shapeways, it will take you like a week or more in order to actually get the final product?
I said this earlier to you guys, you kind of have three different aspects to this. Obviously you've got the app to customise the objects, you've got the marketplace, and then you've got the access to the 3D printers. And I see that Shapeways is kind of sits kind of differently in that ecosystem. But do you think it's critical that you have all three parts of this in place for you to be able to execute, or is there one element of this you can lean more heavily on?
I think for have a successful ecosystem within an app, we need all of the three. So we could actually just provide files and then enable them to have the 3D files ready to print. But I think if you want to grow as an app, as a startup, we need community as well. We need input we want to grow as well.
And when you mentioned community there, I mean, have you, how do you think, how would you fund this, and how do you think, I mean, to get that initial, these kind of bootstrapping costs, and do you know, I'm sorry, you already mentioned it, but how much do you think to get it running?
Right, so the fund, we need to develop further the app, obviously, and in terms of the marketing.
Well, yeah, we're obviously going to use Facebook. Our website would be, in order to acquire actually customers, we will use social media such as Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, our own website as well. And a cost, obviously, would be, a fixed cost would be the salaries that we're paying for social media, for the social media people who advertise, in a way.
So we only need to pay ourselves, or the developers, or the someone who is on Facebook and adds content to it. That's how you plan.
As for the mobile app itself, you did show a demo, but have you tried it on a mobile phone itself? Have you kind of considered the user experience of how you're going to... Because it's quite precise work, even if it's made easier.
Well, Unity is a cross-platform engine, and it already has API built in to enable easier interaction on touchscreen devices. So the technology is already there, we just need to utilize it. And
in terms of how they would use it, we're actually thinking of iPads and tablets. So that's where you have to...
Oh, okay. The landscape.
The right one is the basic menu. It's always there. And the left one always just have to swap. And in terms of how to build, as you can see, there was like actually an orange little circle. And you have to just swap it and place it.
Also, we'll enhance the gravity of the accelerometer to make it more suitable for the app.
Okay, thank you, guys.
This is our last presentation.
Yep, that's the last one.
So, Scalia IO.
Hello, good evening, Edinburgh. I'm Ben.
I'm Ragnar.
Snail.
And he's here.
I'm here.
We are Skillet.io. We're cooking up an application platform for people to be able to collaborate across disciplines more easily, apply and practice the skills they've learned, and be able to track a portfolio of projects that they can show employers after education.
Right, so we identified a demand for this kind of platform by looking at things like the Admiral Skill Swap group that already exists on Facebook, and it has almost 2,000 members, but unfortunately it's very messy, it's not very user-friendly, it's very hard to find people on there, and there's always the need of a proper swap in the terms of I teach you German, you teach me English, that kind of exchange, whereas we're going more for the kind of exchange given by a hackathon where people from different disciplines come together and they work on a project together, they develop it together, and they all take something back from it in the end. As we can see, there is a lot of hackathons going on. There's an interest in this kind of product, but it's rarely done outside of the context of organized hackathons. So we're trying to encourage projects in more personal settings, we have a user story.
Okay, so yeah, hi, I'm Ben again. So I will say I want to practice web development I've learned either during my university course or in my spare time. And I just want to build a portfolio of projects that I can show potential employers after school. I want somewhere that I can advertise that I want to. That I want to practice these skills and apply them in real life and collaborate with people.
Hi, I'm Xue. I study at ECA and I'm a designer. But I have a dream. I want to build a beautiful website. But most of my friends are from ECA and they don't know how to build that website. So I don't know how to start. So I want to find a product to help me solve this problem.
And so we really want to break out of these silos of different disciplines and schools and hackathons. And so we built an MVP, which is available at skillet.io. And so it's basically two parts: an index of users who you can see who are tagged with the skills that we are tagged with today, either developers, developers, designers, or business people, entrepreneurs. Everyone's a kitten on this site. They are definitely best workers. And you're able to filter them by tags. And for example, if you're looking for both a designer and a developer, you can filter it so you have people who have marked themselves as both on the website.
See what Jerry Spring has to offer.
Okay, so that's our MVP. We haven't built profile pages. We haven't built portfolio pages quite yet, but that's going to be the next stage of our development.
So going further, we then kind of renew our basic product, renew the basic consumers that we are trying to target. So we launched a survey that's still ongoing. So far, we've had 16 responses, and 15 people actually said they would like to have more opportunities to practice their skills and improve their skills. And a lot of people would be quite happy to be contacted about projects, although they might not have something particularly in mind, but they're quite happy to work with people and to develop something. And also most people said that they wouldn't mind if sponsored events were suggested to them.
Okay, so we're considering three different possible revenue models in order from least monetizing to least the most lucrative. So in order to be sustainable, we think we would have to maybe charge users to be able to put up premium projects, have something where you tag and say, I want a web developer or I want a designer. And that will show up on people who have marked themselves as such and bring that project to the forefront of their user experience and make that more likely to succeed and to gather users. Secondly, we want to partner with educational institutes of all shapes and sizes, from universities down to small colleges yes. Cool. Any questions?
So have you got competitors in this space at the moment?
Yes, we have. Well, not any true competitors. We fill a strange niche between LinkedIn on one end of the scale, huge website where everyone puts their CVs in order to get hired. No one particularly likes doing it, but they make huge amounts of money out of recruiters, which is going to be our third potential business model.
We've got skill swapping sites, but they're more based on actual swapping of skills, and it's 90% recreational, as in, oh, I need a partner for dancing, but I could teach you Mexican cooking, which isn't kind of... But, I mean, the idea is there, but we're just trying to meet in the middle, saying, you have skills, and you can advertise these skills, and people can approach you, so you don't need... You don't need to single out someone, but rather you just put yourself out there. People can look for you, but you can also search for people with skills that you need for a project and contact them and search, get it all on the way much easier, much quicker.
So are you charging them to list? Are you charging them?
No. We're thinking, because our main target audience is students at the moment, we're in the student community. There seems to be a huge need for this product in the student community. So we don't want to actually charge the students to put anything on there, but rather charge, for example, companies. They want to upload projects and look for people. They would be charged for that, and that's where our revenue would come from.
Absolutely. A lot of the value of the site comes from having a lot of people on it and be able to search for people in your area. We want to grow organically as much as possible and to bring as many people onto the site as we can to make it a valuable resource.
With regard to the MVP that you showed, that looked really nice and slick. But how would it work if you've got the thousands of students on there? How do you manage things like the amount of skill buttons and the amount of hits that you...
That will need to be reorganized. It's just, this is very limited. This is limited to hackathon kind of tags.
If I could take that one briefly, probably have some sort of a taxonomy of skills so you can narrow down what you're looking for a bit more, or possibly have like a type to complete for skills so you can see, you don't see the full list of skills on there, but if you start typing web, it will offer development, design, whatever else, and you can choose the ones that are actually relevant to what you're looking for. And certainly that first view of all the profiles on the page, that would certainly need some rejigging when you got to a higher level of popularity.
And are you assuming that every instance of the tool is going to be kind of local? You know, that for example, you're fishing in just Edinburgh, or Edinburgh and the Logans?
Well, I mean, part of that another question is that another option that we didn't have time to implement, which is why part of the reason why we had that implementation was a search. But obviously, you've got some natural search, like, you know, find someone with development in Edinburgh or otherwise, maybe pull it by location.
Yeah, I mean, we have a location in the profile, so we can potentially give people like a map based search or whatever else. But we want it to be, we want people to be able to go outside their local community. So we have, you know, within the academic community, if you're in Edinburgh University, you might talk to Napier or Harry Watts. So you wouldn't know people there necessarily, but you'd be able to find them through this.
You said already, so to an extent, I mean, the key with this is going to have a lot of people on the platform, which could involve a lot of money or a lot of marketing or piggybacking on existing programs or things that are already out there. So I'm just wondering, in terms of, you mentioned hackathons, obviously, have you got any specific strategies that you would use to piggyback on existing programs? And in particular with Startup Weekend, obviously there's a lot of Startup Weekends going to be running this weekend. Did you get in touch with anyone at Startup Weekend or anything to see if they would be amenable to maybe using this as part of that?
We've not got in touch with anyone yet, if anyone from Startup Weekend or Hackathons, but I am pleased to announce that we will be sending out emails to all of you people if you want to get on the platform, log in and perhaps advertise your skills locally, and continue this sort of thing outside of hackathons and outside of the classroom. It'd be really good to have you on there and to bring you with us on our journey. Thanks very much.
You all, just before the judges get together to decide who's winning, I would like to call on stage Egil, please. Egil is responsible for this dinosaur setup that we have here today, and I would just like her to present her project for just 2 or 3 minutes and explain why she's here.
And please, just will quickly explain what is this. So this is the Dino Forest, the short installation created this weekend for Inside Arcade. As far as I know, Inside Arcade obsessed with dinosaurs. So a week ago, I got pitched to create some kind of magical forest, as I did this installation public space before. And as you can see, it's just kind of evolution and just magical place. A part of this event. So yeah, that's all really. I hope everyone can come and see and discover this.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, everyone. Yes, we are completely obsessed with dinosaurs. Our conference was run at Dynamic Earth, and we made a promise that was quite brash at the beginning that we would have dinosaurs as part of our evening social. We're now going to go away and deliberate. To keep you entertained for the time being, we have Finn from Startup Grind. He's going to do a very special interview with Lee McLaughlin, and he's going to give you some insight about his journey as an entrepreneur and the process of actually going through the actually starting a company and that journey. So thank you very much. And in between, as we get set up for this, probably is it only beer left?
Yeah.
Finish off the beer, please. We don't want to be on the meeting.
When I came here on Friday night, I had the opportunity to meet with a lot of you. The vast majority of you are university students, and it's exciting to actually see that there's a very strong startup culture in a sense. One of the things I'm involved with is Startup Grind, which is a global community which we are sponsored by Google for Entrepreneurs. And one of the ethos behind it is to connect, inspire, and educate. Now, you can get your formal education in universities, which is great. They teach you a lot of the theoretical side of things, and in some extent, the practical side of things. Then you come to a hackathon weekend like this. I had a chat with one of the ladies who does kind of natural programming. She says, I wouldn't normally come along to something that was called a hackathon, because it's pretty much very, you know, it's such a male-orientated or dominated term. And I'm just delighted to obviously see a strong contingent of females in the group. So, ladies, give yourself a... Last week or 2 weeks ago, there was a little survey that went around. I don't know if some of you saw it, which spoke of Google's male-dominated culture. And it's great to obviously see females embracing, you know, hackathons at the end of the day, because as you've seen, it isn't just about hacking code. A lot of it is about collaboration, teamwork, and ideation at the end of the day, and getting up there and obviously pitching your product. We are, in a sense, a bit fortunate when Alan said, look, whilst we're having the judges doing their deliberation, why don't you give a bit of a chat and let's get an entrepreneur that's been there and done that. Because in a sense, that's what Startup Grind is all about. We've been fortunate enough to have speakers like, you know, Clayton Christensen of Harvard Business School, who's done written the book The Innovator's Dilemma. We've had Jess Livingston of the Y Combinator. Here in Edinburgh, we've had Gareth Williams of Skyscanner, Leslie Eccles of FanDraw, Colin Ewart of Float, Ed Molyneux of Free Agent, and this month we've got Michael Welch of Black Circle. So if you are in Edinburgh and you want to come along to the event, it's free. We put on drinks and food at the end of the day. But today we've got a great entrepreneur at the end of the day. He didn't want me to use this term, actually. He said to me, Finn, you know, oh, I hate that entrepreneur term. I say, look, you know, at the end of the day, we're all entrepreneurs. From the day we're born to whether we work for a corporate company, whether we do our own startup, we're all entrepreneurs. Because entrepreneurship, at the end of the day, my personal belief anyway, is about actually having a deep belief in your idea and actually going out there to execute it. And that can certainly be in a corporate environment. I mean, Clayton Christensen speaks a lot about this way in his book, The Innovator's Dilemma, and he talks how entrepreneurship does still thrive in the corporate culture. So when we talk about Startup Grind, it isn't necessarily just targeted towards starting your own company and literally going through that grind of going through a company. You can still be a startup in a corporate company. So I'd like to introduce Lee McLaughlin. Did I pronounce that correct?
Close enough.
Close enough. you should try and poke for people. People really get that very complicated. Lee has a startup company called IC Mobile. He's got a fascinating story, and he'll be certainly sharing that today. But he actually comes from a corporate background, one which went through various acquisitions, and we'll certainly touch on that today. He started up his startup company back in 2011, which does mobile augmentation reality, something along those lines. Very complex for me. And we'll certainly touch on that again. So if we can give him a big product forward. Okay, so the format that we tend to do is we'll sit down, we'll have a little chat. I'll basically fire off a few questions to him. I don't do the whole reserve your questions and answers for the end. If you feel that, you know, Lee touches on something kind of pertinent at that particular moment in time, raise your hand, ask him a question, no matter how probing it obviously is. And hopefully, I'm sure he'll basically he'll basically answer it. So, Lee, welcome to a kind of startup grind product four.
Thank you. Glad to be happy. I guess I'll clear up. It's not that I hate the word entrepreneur. I can't bring myself to call myself it.
Okay. Why is that?
It's going to sound like a really stupid reason, but I remember watching about 2 or 3 years ago, watching an episode of, what's that? You've Been Fired. The Apprentice.
Lord Sugar.
And Lord Sugar's quote was, an entrepreneur is something you're called, not something you call yourself.
Okay.
But it just stuck with me.
Fantastic. Okay, great. So tell us, I mean, I had a look at your LinkedIn profile. You got on the graduate software program at Symbian.
Yep.
Talk us through from basically that journey back to tell you where you are today.
So I always had an inkling that I wanted to start my own company when I was at university, but I wanted to get into industry and get some experience first.
Okay.
So about 6 months before graduating, I applied for the graduate scheme. Told them I was on course to get a 2-1, which mathematically was possible at that time.
And was that in software engineering?
Computer science, electronics.
Right, okay.
So I managed to get a job at Symbian and really got to work with a lot of smart people. And I don't really feel like I developed as a software engineer until I was in that work environment, despite what you can learn at university.
Would you say for anyone that's basically, you know, in the process of about to graduate right about now, that going through a graduate program at a corporate company is important, or almost throwing yourself in at the deep end right into the startup culture from your own personal experience of what you learned today? What would be your thought process?
I can't speak highly enough of the value I thought that I got from getting into the industry. Okay. And I thought it gave me a good perspective and all the things that I probably overlooked,
right.
Like, you know, how do you make sure your product actually reaches a good quality level? How do you release code? And I suppose there must be similarities in design and business development that you just get. You get a good framework to work within, so you're not kind of getting out there and trying everything and failing 50% of the time. You know, you go in there and you see how a corporate culture's done it. And corporate culture is all about minimising risk and minimising failure.
Okay.
So you kind of get that perspective of it.
Okay,
but it feels limiting at the same time, so that's great. So you get to work for that benefit and then leave and fail 50% of the time.
So Symbian gets acquired by Nokia.
Yep.
And then Nokia gets acquired by Accenture. So you literally go from Symbian to Nokia to Accenture, all through basically acquisitions. How is that process, obviously, from you as a software engineer? How did you cope with the transition of the different cultures between the organisations?
I think the biggest transition was going out from Nokia to Accenture.
Okay.
When you went from Symbian to Nokia, it was still two engineering-focused firms. They were at different scales. In terms of Symbian was about 2,000 compared to Nokia's scale, which probably 2,000 in an engineering team. And so the scale problem, you start to see communication problems right away as soon as you move from Symbian to Nokia. And then when you move from Nokia to Accenture, it's just a management consultant. How much this is going out in the podcast? It's just a kind of large management consultancy firm. So they didn't understand as much the needs of software engineers.
Right.
And I think we're probably a temperamental bunch. I don't know if anybody will agree with that.
Right, so you're now at Accenture, and at some point, I guess, your entrepreneurial instincts kick in. What was the final trigger that said, right, I'm setting up on my own?
I kind of set myself a trigger of, if I don't get 2 promotions in 2 years, then I'm going to leave. And I knew that was probably unattainable because the cycle of promotions at that company are out with that. But I used it as a good way to kind of force myself to make the leap. And at that time, I was balancing up things like I had no real risk to take. You know, if I went freelance, I could make a similar salary. I'd been on a grad salary for 3.5 years because of divestments. My salary didn't progress. So it made it all really easy as a decision, I think.
Okay, fantastic. You obviously had a software engineering background, and you could have basically gone into any number of things from a startup. Why did you decide to go into mobile?
Well, I guess when I was working at these companies, I was working with mobile operating systems, so I had a really good understanding. So I would work on the API layer, the layer that any of the developers would build applications on top of. So I felt like I had a good understanding about kind of robust architecturing of mobile applications. And more importantly, what I really learned from the good developers was design patterns,
right.
Which are very transferable across lots of platforms. So I thought that'd be the best approach. And it was a big trend, you know what I mean? The mobile app development, it was like the buzzword of the time.
And you do, right, remind me,
augmented reality.
Augmented reality.
Yeah.
What is it? Like, I hear it's this big buzzword. It's almost like big data, you know? Big data is a big buzzword.
It's an umbrella term, but it basically means when you hold up your phone and you look at the world through your camera, you can see any kind of digital information overlaid. In the early days, you would hold it up and you'd see the outside world through your phone, and there might be a hovering bubble that says 3 miles in that direction is another cafe. And it really kind of progressed over time, so that now you can hold your phone over the centrefold of a Top Gear magazine and you can see the BMW that they're trying to sell you on top of your desk. And that can be a digital toy that you can drive about your desk. So it's about doing 3D visualizations tied to the real world. So if you imagine your phone acts as a looking glass into this kind of digital, mysterious world of hidden content.
So day one, did you have an office or you were working from home?
No, working from home.
Fantastic. Okay. So clearly a startup. You know, you know you're really a startup when you actually start working from home. You know, that's kind of like a big tip. And it sounds good as well. So you're a startup. Yeah, where's your first office? In my home. So you're working from home.
We did rent a place with a garage, and I did.
Oh, look at that, in the garage, yeah.
I put a chair in there just like a sit in it once and say that I started in the garage.
Awesome. So, day one, 9 o'clock in the morning, you get to your desk, you open up your laptop. What's the first thing kind of going through your head? You're now a startup. You know?
Yeah.
You're now officially a startup. What's going through your head?
I knew when I was going to run out of money. So while I was working at Accenture, I took on my first project, kind of freelance mobile development job, got some money in the bank out of that.
Yep.
And the first thing that was going on in my head was, shit, we're going to run out of money at some point, you've got to find customers.
And what did you do to go out there and get?
Because of the kind of, one of the reasons that I'd actually decided to take a leave as well was that I'd started to get word of mouth referrals. So a lot of it was that. I was lucky enough to go, I had to then go out and search in my network to try and get those referrals, and I managed to get a consultancy job initially.
Yeah.
With an American based startup, which allowed me enough capital to then look 5 months down the line at doing a graphic designer bringing on board.
Awesome. So your first employee,
yeah.
Talk us through that scenario.
Met at a startup weekend, the first one that was running in Glasgow, which was great because I got a chance to work with them in a team. So there wasn't much of an interview process after that, to be honest. It was, hey, we worked really great, let's go for a coffee. He worked part-time, he worked at university at the time,
right.
So we took him part-time. I wasn't worried about that at that time. Because it was a kind of part-time role, I knew how he worked. It got scarier later on with future hires when there's no kind of point of reference to go on.
Okay, so you've obviously gone from software engineer to Accenture, which is more management consultancy, obviously orientated. You then start up your company, you're now a CEO. Did you have any experience managing?
I performed a tech lead role in Accenture, just on project-based small projects. So it was never... Sometimes that's working with more experienced engineers. It's just that I'm doing the kind of daily tech lead and divvying up tasks, etc. You're in a controlling management position. You're just kind of being collaborative.
But now, obviously, as a startup, you are dealing with, you know, a lot of complicated things like, you know, ordering the toilet paper, and, you know, making tea and coffee, and obviously doing the coding. How did you adjust?
Well, my mum taught me how to make a great cup of tea, so that was
awesome.
But I tried to, you know, I wanted to build a place that I wanted to work in.
Right.
And some of that is that I hate being, it's not that I hate being told what to do, it's that I hate not having any feedback loop in that, where I can add my insight from kind of the cold face. In some respects, I was probably too lax starting out, so I went for the uber friendly boss. You know, hey guys, I'll make the tea. which kind of worked out because we had a good atmosphere, but there was a couple of near misses where I wasn't.
Now you've obviously had some growth, you're a few employees through. How has the entire hiring process worked? I mean, you touched on it, there's been a bit of hit and miss.
Yeah.
I guess maybe the first question is, how have you handled hiring, and how have you handled buying?
In one respect, I was hiring through a scheme for a set project length. I didn't actually have an option around removing that hire, so
right.
What I had to do was try and mitigate the risk and set them on certain tasks just to try and extract the value that I could over the period of the project.
Okay.
As a learning lesson from that, any future hires, we would generally try and take in an intern over a period to do a scheme and then turn that into a full-time position.
Okay.
To kind of try before you buy, if you like.
Yeah.
And secondly, we do have provision within our contracts for probationary periods. Because I think that it's not fair to say that sometimes people don't meet the expectations. Sometimes you don't clearly express the expectations of you when you're a startup.
Yeah.
It can be a lot more demanding than getting into a corporate job and being able to clock off at 5 o'clock. And I'm not saying I work anybody past 5 o'clock. It just takes a lot of your headspace, I think.
And obviously, to anyone that is here who has been through this experience, obviously others are, whether they're in their fourth year or others have recently graduated, is there three pieces of advice you would pass on to them?
I guess if you're going right in and kind of starting up, know when you're going to run out of money. At some point, just know that you might, and it's okay, because lots of people do run out of money along the way.
Debt bank.
Yeah, I mean, the startup failure rate's through the roof.
Yeah.
But with all that stress, you just get a sense of being driven by your own vision and your own goals. So you get control how good or how bad you feel about it. The other one is about ecosystems and being involved in the kind of startup ecosystem.
Yeah.
You should always take a kind of approach to give more than you take out, because you'll pay dividends with it by just giving your support and giving your help to other people. And third one, I guess this is a tripe and always carried out, but you know, hire great people and hire people that are better than yourself, because you can't do it all. And I think if I was going starting again,
yep,
I would start with a co-founder rather than being a solo founder.
Really? I mean, I hear that co-founder kind of spewed out a lot.
Yeah.
I personally don't believe it. One of the reasons why is I almost think you almost need a champion. I mean, we look at a lot of great kind of startup companies, whether it is Apple, you know, Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, but people only really kind of sing the praises of Steve Jobs. And ultimately, you need a leader or a face.
I did say you had to share the spotlight equally.
Ah, right.
just that you had to share the workload equally.
But someone's always got to steal the spotlight.
Yeah, of course. There's always got to be a front man in the hand.
Awesome.
Can I ask a question along those lines?
Yeah.
You're speaking of a co-founder, and I know one of the reasons you went into a startup is because it allowed you to kind of follow your own vision. Do you not find that bringing someone else in creates some problems with that, and all of a sudden you're having to balance between the ideas of two people,
yeah,
rather than one?
So
great question, thank you.
It depends where that idea came from. If it came out of a kind of shared vision between the two of you, then you're probably all right. And you should probably define the boundaries really clearly of where you want to take the vision and the focus of your kind of minimum viable products, etc. And your route to it. I would go through essentially this exercise and say, do we all agree that all these 10 slides are exactly what we're doing? For me, I'm actually looking at bringing someone into the management team who's, I guess at this point, not quite a co-founder, but I guess at that respect, we're so far along the line that they need to get on board with my vision of what we've done now and where we're going. And if they can't, then they're not the right co-founder.
Brilliant. Fantastic. Thank you. Any other questions from anyone? Donald.
Hi. So obviously the topic of the weekend is educational technology. So have you used augmented reality to build anything in that space? Or do you know any best examples from Oxford?
Yeah. So we haven't. But what we looked at when we were building out products was kind of four verticals, and education was one of them. So we had, you can see in health as well, and actually there's a mix of education and health. Probably a good example is Anatomy 4D. Which was built on a similar platform that we did, and what it does is it allows medical students to visualise the whole human anatomy on their desk and to kind of go in and view each of the organs as if there was a human body lying on the desk, not for the Swedish. But I definitely see a value add proposition to traditional textbooks in the classroom, and being able to say that an atom spins around. That an electron spins around an atom, and being able to whip out an iPad and go, there's an atom and there's an electron, look at it spinning, I think has tremendous value. So I could definitely see it. We've got a product in mind, but I won't share it now.
Well, thank you.
Great, thank you. Thanks, Donald. Any other questions from anyone?
As a start, I thought in relation to today's problems we've heard in other presentations, lack of movement in front of the computer or self-help books, how do you find this balance between, because obviously you spend most of the time, how do you find a balance between work and leisure? And
I don't. I tend to work far too much. I guess I'm looking at it as I'm putting in a lot of time, effort, and sacrificing some of that leisure time now, because I want it to pay out in kind of 3 years' time, and then I'll get all the leisure I want. In terms of kind of self-help books and stuff, I do read some startup books. The E-Myth was great for me because it talks about when you start as the technician in a company. You often feel that I build the stuff, so you know I can sell it and everything else. It talks about the kind of fallacy in that, and how if you're going to really build a company, you might start out as a technical person, but you need to consider either you're bringing someone else in to run the business side of it, or you need to develop into the business side and move away from the technician side.
Thank you.
In terms of augmented reality, have you started to think about stuff like or something like other than just mobiles or computers?
Yeah. So the main issue with Google Glass just now is it might be where mobile devices are in terms of power in 3 years' time, but right now a lot of the image recognition is done off device in the cloud. So I think some of the AR examples you'll see are based on GPS and compass-based examples, which are what was happening in 2009 with LiDAR on mobile. So I think it will catch up, and I think when it does, we'll be ready for that platform, because I would expect, and this is just a guess, is that they must kind of homogenise the platforms from mobile and Google Glass eventually as the technology matures.
Fantastic, thank you. Any other questions?
A very basic question, just because I don't really know much about augmented reality, but you're talking about the idea of sort of projection and being able to see things. So firstly, does that mean we'd need sort of some add-on features to, for example, your iPad, so you'd be able to project this sort of hologram thing?
You just need a mobile application. Okay. And as you look at that table, as if you were about to take a photograph of it, you would see extra information overlaid. So you would see the camera as if you were about to take a photo, and you might see a lamp on the table that isn't really there. And you'd be able to walk around and explore that 3D object as if it was part of your environment.
Okay, and is that technology already available, or how long would it be until that's kind of available to the general public?
Yeah, so it's already available to the general public. Our differentiating factor is around, similar to kind of 3D develop there, we see that the issue is around creating 3D content. So we encourage 3D artists to upload, and we're selling to advertising agencies. They're using it as a kind of add-on layer to the print ads that they're already selling, to facilitate interaction and kind of feedback.
Awesome. To see how you validated like the 3D, pre-developed kind of business model over at one day. You had a question over there.
Oh, yeah, I was just wondering if, when you do this, kind of just technical questions, so, when you use your application, is it image recognition or is there something on the outside object, like a QR code or something?
Yeah, it uses image recognition. In the next 3 months, what we'll be able to do is just use any flat surface to visualise the content. But that adds the different user interaction because then you need to pre-select the content you want to visualise. Whereas when we use the image as the target, we know what content that image is linked to.
Fantastic. Okay, that's great. Well, Lee, just wanted to give you a really huge thank you very much for also sharing your insights into how you got started along the way. And we certainly wish you every success with your friend. Well, thank you, everyone. I believe the judges are ready to come and share what will hopefully be good news for someone. But once again, I just wanted to say a huge congratulations to you all. You've all done absolutely fantastically well. You're welcome to connect with me on Twitter, on LinkedIn. Certainly, I've worked with all of you, so anyone that is after a personal recommendation, if you're on LinkedIn professionally, I think connect with me and I'll be more than happy to give you a personal recommendation. It works very well for your CV when employers are kind of looking into seeing what you've actually done, and weekends like this certainly help that. So feel free to contact with me on LinkedIn or Twitter.
You guys feel ready to announce the winner? So I'm going to call judges Richard, who has been your mentor throughout the weekend. And if you want to give them a round of applause as well.
Okay, folks. Mm-hmm. Danny will be announcing the results. Shall we start at number three?
There's no number three. Look, first of all, you can probably tell we took a bit longer than we thought we were going to take out there. So it was a very, very close run thing. A lot of discussion that we had. So what we've decided is there's no number three, of course. There's just a couple of number twos. So if I could ask the runners-up, Met PhD, and Don't Miss Out, to come up on stage. So, who won? This is the key to the office at TechCuba, I'm sure. A token thereof. To the winner's story.
To the participants over the weekend. You've all done absolutely fantastically. I want to thank our judges, our mentors, and our team again. And that's it. And thank you to all of you. We're going to have some one or two or three or five drinks at the Grass Monkey just around the corner. So give yourselves a round of applause, and I'll see you then.